From Interfaith Alliance, this is State of Belief Radio. I'm your host, Reverend Welton Gaddy. This week we're broadcasting from the Argo Studios in New York City. For the past few weeks, I've been asking you to submit questions that we could answer on this year-end program. As I've been saying, these are not the answers, but they are my answers, and we'll get to some of them a little later in this week's show. But first,
Mormonism is not historical Christianity. It is a theological cult.
Do you believe that President Obama is a Christian?
Well, I think you have to ask President Obama.
Legalizing same-sex marriage in three states and beating back a constitutional amendment effort in Minnesota.
The MTA did try to block the ads from going up.
A group of Catholic nuns are questioning Ryan's interpretation of social justice. They are embarking on a bus tour.
It's been a long, long year at the intersection of religion, government, and politics. But something we do annually here at State of Belief Radio is pause to take a look back and weigh which religion news stories had the most impact on us. We're fortunate again this year to be able to ask Kevin Ekstrom to come on our show. Kevin is editor-in-chief at Religion News Service. Kevin, welcome back to State of Belief Radio.
Always fun to be here.
One danger, but also one good thing about doing this show is we keep an archive. And so I went back to last year's Religion News Roundup, on which you were the guest, and I heard you call 2011 the year of taking it to the streets, from the Arab Spring to Occupy Wall Street. We were talking about a lot of people around the world pushing back against real or perceived oppression. When you look at the top stories now for 2012, what kind of theme comes to mind?
Well, there's the obvious one, and then there's the more, what I think, interesting one. And the obvious one is the election. 2012 was all about the race for the White House. It kind of dominated everything, and everything was sort of tied to the election. And I think the more interesting one is the things that we saw this year that kind of indicated fairly dramatic social change on a number of different levels. One of the most fascinating trends that emerged this year, and that's going to have some legs going well beyond 2013, was figures that showed that one in five Americans now don't have a religious affiliation. They're called the nuns. They're either an atheist or secularist or just a really good person, but they don't attend a church or synagogue or mosque. And what's really interesting is that 90% of them don't really have an interest. They're not looking. They're not seekers. You know, seekers were all the rage a couple years ago. These people have either not started or given up on it. And I think that trend has a lot of implications for religious America to think about and to wrestle with. Some people think it's a great thing. Some people think that it's a cause of concern to establish churches, and some people think it's going to change the way we do religion and politics. And I think all of that is true. But it really changes the notion of America as a Christian country, certainly, but also as a religious country. I mean, we're still certainly religious. You know, 80% of us have some sort of affiliation. But the growth among all religions is not in the established churches. It's not among evangelicals or Catholics. Or mainline churches, it's among the nuns, the people who just don't want to have a religion.
Kevin, what's interesting to me is there has been a lot of change within a number of religious denominations this year. What I wonder is whether it is the right change at this moment, because I happen to think that the nuns are actually making a new context that, if ignored by religious denominations, will be to their detriment.
That's right. I mean, if churches wrestle all the time with how do we get people in the doors, and once they're here, how do we keep them? And with these surveys, and there were several actually, what they're showing us is that, you know what, a lot of people don't even want to come to your doors, and you might never get them. And if you want to reach them, they are largely going to be put off by religiosity, by preachiness, by taking religion into the public square in an inappropriate way. They don't want to have fights about abortion and same-sex marriage and God in schools. They have no interest in it. And I think what we saw in the election and in certain races was that politicians who got too preachy or who adopted a stance that was seen as too strident, particularly on questions of rape and abortion, they didn't do very well. Mm-hmm. And that, I think, is a bit of a canary in the coal mine here. Politicians who insist on dragging religion into the public square are going to be met with an increasingly hostile response, mm-hmm. or maybe not even hostile, but ambivalent response. These people, the nuns, the surveys indicate, they're not hostile towards religion per se. Like, if you want to go to church, that's fine, but don't bring it into my life.
Yeah.
And that's a change for politics, but it's also a change for a lot of churches.
We saw a lot of internal conflict within the Catholic Church this year. And I've got to respell nuns. The
right.
Nuns, N-U-N-S, the nuns on the bus made headlines with their push for social justice. Is there going to be a lasting impact to the conflicts that we've seen this year within the Catholic Church?
Well, yes. And I think we should also say that when we're talking about the nuns, N-U-N-S, there's really two different stories playing out here. One is sort of the social justice nuns who were out campaigning against Paul Ryan's budget and saying, you know, we need to protect the poor. And they did it in a more visible public way than they probably have done it in recent years, and they were very successful at it. And their message seemed to resonate with people. You know, the consensus that came out of the election was that if we have to make cuts in the budget, that's fine, but we're not going to do it on the backs of programs that help the poor, and we're certainly not going to do it in ways so that millionaires can keep their tax cuts. And that's what the nuns were saying. And so I think they were remarkably successful. They found their voice on this issue this year, and I think they're going to continue to have an impact there. The other story, though, with the nuns was the crackdown that came from the Vatican when the Vatican basically accused them of being too socially liberal, spending too much time on social justice and not enough on abortion and homosexuality. And the really interesting part of all that was that the nuns were able to really draw large support from rank-and-file Catholics. You know, Catholics who stood outside of churches with signs saying, "We love our sisters," and "Honk if you love a nun," and telling the Vatican to step back. You know, you're picking the wrong fight with the wrong group of ladies here. And that's something that you hadn't seen in a while. And so I think to the degree that the nuns are under investigation or are seen to be being picked on, the church is going to have a hard time with that.
We've got to take a quick break, but when we come back, I want to ask Kevin Ekstrom about what religion stories or headlines have really most impacted the secular world. I'll ask him that in just a moment. I'm Welton Gaddy. You're listening to State of Belief Radio, brought to you by Interfaith Alliance. Welcome back, everyone, to State of Belief Radio. I'm Welton Gaddy. This week, we're taking a look at the top religion stories of 2012 with Religion News Service Editor-in-Chief Kevin Ekstrom. Kevin, what religion stories or religion headlines have most impacted the secular world this year, in your opinion?
I think, you know, one of the big ones, it's not a religion story per se, but it's certainly a religious issue. 2012 was a huge year in terms of gay rights, specifically on the question of gay marriage.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we had four states on election day that voted to approve it, essentially, and one in North Carolina back in May that voted to ban it. But it's the first time that the ballot box has actually been a win for the gay side. And even more than all of that, the number that really jumped out at me this year was a Gallup poll from May, which found that 54% of Americans now see homosexual relations as morally acceptable. It's the first time that a majority has ever said that. And increasing majorities of people are okay with the idea of gay marriage. So to the extent that churches and religious groups are fighting this, at least demographically, they seem to be on the wrong side. Now, I'm not saying that they're wrong or that they're ultimately going to lose, but the trend lines are pretty clear. For the under 30 set, this is a non-issue. And other surveys indicate that for young people, churches that are seen as anti-gay are a turnoff, and they don't want to go to those kinds of places because they have friends, they have family, they have teachers who are gay, and they don't see a problem with it. 2012 set the stage for 2013, and that's when the Supreme Court is going to get involved. And it's not entirely clear, A, how they're going to rule, because it never is. But the justices have a couple of different options in terms of how wide a ruling they want to do. They can make it a smaller one. They could make it a broad-based one. They could even come out and say that there's a constitutional right to same-sex marriage. So it's not clear how far they're going to go. But 2013, I think, is going to be as important to this issue as 2012 was.
I'm really glad you brought that up. I've always liked asking you whether or not the mainstream media have covered that news adequately. So what stories deserved more attention than they got?
The trickiest one, and but probably the one that I would have liked to have seen teased out a little bit more, gets back to Mitt Romney and kind of Mormon theology. You know, we heard a lot about how evangelicals are suspicious about Mormons, and they don't really like them very much. But it never really, in my view anyway, got beneath the surface there. What is it about Mormon theology that is problematic for other Christians? What exactly do Mormons believe, and why? And part of the Mormon mystique, if you will, is some of these, you know, very unorthodox beliefs. You know, one of them being that, you know, the Garden of Eden was once in Missouri, and Jesus might return there someday. Now, in the grand scheme of things, that's a fairly minor Mormon belief, but yet it's there. I think a lot of mainstream media were scared off by that, and maybe understandably so. And there's a danger in dwelling too much on a candidate's faith. You don't need me to tell you that. But because Mitt Romney's identity was so wrapped up in his Mormonism and his life and his career, I think, you know, there could have been more exploration about what Mormons believe, even if it's not necessarily what he believes.
Kevin, can you list maybe the top five religion news stories of the year as ranked by Religion News Service?
Well, this year we did something a little different. We didn't pick a top 10 list, although we did do kind of top 10 stories that we thought were significant. So, for example, the gun shootings in Connecticut, but not just Connecticut, but also Aurora, Colorado, and the Sikh temple in Wisconsin. I think that is going to be a story that is going to take us into next year, and there's probably going to be some action about that. Of course, we had the nuns, the secularists that we talked about, the Catholic nuns, the other nuns, Mitt Romney's Mormon moment, gay rights, the fight between the Catholic bishops and evangelicals and the Obama White House over contraception, I think was fascinating and still ongoing. And then, of course, the Catholic Church's continuing wrestling with clergy sex abuse. What was significant on that this year is, one, it marks the 10-year anniversary since all of this exploded in 2002 in Boston. But we also had two criminal convictions, the highest level criminal convictions, and really the first two, of church officials, one bishop and one Monsignor, but he was in charge of the clergy, who were convicted for not doing enough, for not reporting this suspect to the police, and also for shuffling priests who were known to have problems from one church to another.
When you look at all of those stories, in addition to the hundreds of others that you reported on this year, do you think that in the culture wars, we are more entrenched in our divisions, or do you see any signs of building bridges?
I'm sort of a glass half full, half empty on this, because I kind of want to have it both ways. Out of the election, there seemed to be a message of, you know what, we don't agree. And chances are we're not going to agree. But we have some pretty major problems as a country, particularly financial, and we need to do something. And we're seeing now in Washington, you know, just the difficulty of getting us to stop short of going over the fiscal cliff. So it's not going to be easy. And I don't know how much has really changed, but there seems to be a popular sentiment for Congress and also maybe the White House to stop the shenanigans and get back to work and actually do something.
Yeah.
And I think you're also seeing that in the gun debate after the Connecticut shootings. People can have their various disagreements on gun rights and the Second Amendment and all of that, but there seems to be a consensus that something has gotten out of hand and that there has to be room for reasonable restrictions that are going to prevent first graders from getting gunned down in their class. So I think, you know, there is this sentiment that it's time to put the foolishness aside and do something. Mm-hmm. Whether or not Washington can break its bad habits and actually do that, we're going to have to wait till 2013 to see.
What was the top good news religion story of 2012? And we got to be positive, even if we have to make ourselves be positive.
Well, I suppose the Pope joining Twitter probably doesn't really count. You know, this also falls into my category of most underreported story, perhaps.
Okay.
When the U.S. consulate in Libya was attacked and we lost four diplomats, there was this, you know, stupid anti-Islam movie that was blamed for it. Turns out probably wasn't what sparked it. But anyway, this movie got a lot of attention. And not too long after, President Obama delivered an address that I think probably didn't get as much attention as it maybe should have, but I thought it was the most significant religion speech that he has given in his term as president so far. But he basically called for a new understanding of how religions need to get along in the world. And if anything else, this kooky video showed us, you know, how explosive the situation can be and how interconnected we really are. And President Obama basically said, you know what, if we're going to get along, we need to actually respect another person's religion, even when we disagree with it. And if you're going to call out the faults of other religions, you have to look inward and call out the faults in your own as well. Fascinating speech. I think it really painted a new picture of what religion in public life and in global life can be,
mm-hmm.
and we'll sort of see what the legs are going forward, but that would sort of be my pick for most interesting and hopefully positive story.
And it's a good model for all of us involved in a pluralistic society.
That's right.
I've been speaking with Kevin Ekstrom, editor-in-chief for Religion News Service, an invaluable resource for any of us concerned with the role religion plays in our daily lives and in the life of our nation. Despite how loaded a subject religion is in our culture, you will find RNS consistently covers it in a way that is secular, objective, and comprehensive. The address is www.religionnews.com. Kevin, thank you for being with us on this important news roundup once more here on State of Belief Radio. Just a reminder, there will be more of this conversation with Kevin Ekstrom, as well as of all of the interviews you hear every week, available online at stateofbelief.com. I'll be back with some answers to your questions after this break. You're listening to State of Belief Radio. I'm Welton Gaddy. This free State of Belief Radio podcast is brought to you by Interfaith Alliance, representing 185,000 members across the U.S., drawn from 75 different faith traditions. We're committed to protecting faith and freedom. Find out about the work we do to protect the boundaries between religion and government and unite diverse voices to challenge extremism and build common ground by visiting our website, interfaithalliance.org. Whether you care deeply about minority religious rights, school bullying, LGBT discrimination, the influence of religion on politics, or the influence of politics on religion, Interfaith Alliance is working on initiatives you'll want to support. Learn more and become a member at interfaithalliance.org. Welcome back to State of Belief Radio. I'm Welton Getty. For the past few weeks, I've been asking for your questions so that I could answer a few of them on this week's show. Maybe we'll have dialogue as we go through next year. Thanks to everybody who took the time to participate. We received this call on our listener line.
Hello, Reverend Getty. This is Dave from San Jose, California. And my question for you concerns marriage equality and the First Amendment. My understanding of marriage as an institution is that it was originally a religious ceremony which was granted official legal power by governments that recognized religious rights or the power of a church. And yet I never hear proponents of marriage equality denouncing discriminatory marriage laws as a violation of the First Amendment's guarantee of freedom of religion. Why then are legislators allowed to use religious doctrine as justification to ban a purely legal contract between same-gender couples? It just seems so clear to me that laws against marriage equality are completely unconstitutional. Thanks, as always, for tackling these difficult subjects on State of Belief.
Dave, thank you so much for your question. It gets right at the heart of the misuse of religion in our nation, even at the highest levels of our government. The truth is that we don't know whether religious ceremonies of marriage predated just ceremonies of marriage or not. What we do know is that in this nation, marriage equality is based on law, not religion. And it is a right that should be available to any citizen of the United States, just like the rest of civil rights are. However, we have found politicians very willing to use religious language and to quote scripture in order to preserve marriage as only an institution that involves a man and a woman. That's not what the Constitution says. So the whole debate about same-gender marriage is not a religious debate. It is a civil debate. And what's right for one citizen should be a right for every other citizen. All you need to get married in the United States is a license that no religious institution can issue. They're all issued by the government. The truth about this issue is it does not impact a church's or a minister's right to say, I won't perform a same-gender marriage. They retain that right of discrimination. I have personally refused to marry heterosexual couples simply because I didn't think they were ready to get married or I saw major problems. However, all of these people should already be able to go to a government agency and get its blessing through the issue of a license for same-gender marriage. Thankfully, we're moving closer and closer to that being a reality across this nation, holding our breath about the decision that the Supreme Court may make in the coming year. Marriage is a guaranteed right implicit in the First Amendment to the Constitution, and it does not violate religious freedom because institutions of religion and their leaders are still free to make whatever decision they choose to make about whomever comes to them for marriage. Thank you for asking such a good question. Dina asked the question, I would like to obtain a reading list for understanding of various religions, especially Islam. Well, Dana, that's another really good question, and I want to take some time to ponder the answer I give you because it's a question that puts responsibility on me to put you in touch with good resources. So I'm going to post my answer to your question on stateofbelief.com in the next week or two so that you will have that in print and others can benefit from you asking the question as well. Phil asks, I have appreciated the Interfaith Alliance and your message of acceptance and tolerance for all faiths. Are there any churches or spiritual organizations in the Fort Myers, Florida area? I would love to connect with like-minded individuals. Blessings, Phil. And Phil, we will also post for you information on some of the local Alliance chapters, Interfaith Alliance chapters. These are people who probably think like you, and they would have good information and good encouragement for you as well. And Phil, thanks so much for the good question. Now, there were two anonymous questions. Let me take the first one. How can you call yourself a Christian if you don't adhere to biblical teachings? Well, the big bugaboo in that question is, what are biblical teachings? And you say, well, they're the teachings of the Bible. Well, let me tell you, the complex problem that we face is that unless you read the Bible with some intelligence about the nature of different kinds of literature, some of the nuances of language, you may misunderstand. For example, if you read poetry in the Bible and put it on the same level as narrative in the Bible, then you take projected images, metaphors, to be real historical facts, and they're not. They were never intended to be. So you have to know what kind of writing you are reading in the Scripture. Now, I don't know whether you want to call yourself a Christian on the basis of how you read the Bible or not. I call myself a Christian because that is the tradition with which I identify. The motivations in Christianity are those that become priorities in my life. But I will tell you, I also like very much what I heard about a Quaker man who lived in New England, and some evangelists came to his door and said, "Are you a Christian?" And he said, "Go ask my neighbor." I think that may be the best answer to this question in relation to anybody. And so one more question here, anonymous. Why are you a useful idiot for the Muslims? Well, I didn't know I was, frankly. I thought that I was trying to exercise the compassion and inclusion that are at the center of my religion, and that means reaching out to people who share common values and who share a faith in the same God and who work for the redemption of humankind in terms of a quality of life that is based on the basics of compassion and morality and love. Now, I noticed that Muslims is the word, not Muslims, and so I wonder how much this anonymous person knows about Islam to begin with. There are good sources. You do not need to listen to bigoted people talk about Islam. You need to look at some of the greatest models of that faith tradition and to learn what is within it in terms of the spiritual practices involved, of the goals for society involved, of the great emphasis on prayer, but also on generosity in charitable giving. Perhaps you need to revisit the meaning of Islam and the meaning of being a Muslim. Well, thanks to all of you for the questions that you submitted, and we're going to continue answering them on future shows. So keep the listener line number handy, 800-856-0277. Well, it's time for a break, but up next, we'll send our producer, Ray Kirstein, to get answers to a couple of more questions. I'm Welton Gaddy. You're listening to State of Belief Radio, brought to you by Interfaith Alliance. Welcome back, everyone, to State of Belief Radio. I'm Welton Gaddy. Last week on this show, we heard from Rabbi Brad Hirschfield on his inspiring approach to Christmas from a Jewish perspective. Another group that diverges from the cultural calendar this time of the year, what is the season of Christmas like for American pagans? We sent producer Ray Kirstein to ask, what's that like?
Deborah Lipp became a Wiccan high priestess in 1986 and has been teaching Wicca and running pagan circles ever since. She's been published in many publications, has authored numerous books and lectures widely. Deborah, welcome to State of Belief Radio.
Thank you.
I'd like to start by asking you about the biggest misunderstanding about the pagan religion.
Well, I would say that the basic misunderstandings are either that pagan is a synonym for no faith at all, or that pagan has some relation to Satanism, neither of which is at all true. Paganism is a very diverse group of people with a lot of traditions and denominations within it, but in general, as an umbrella term, it is earth-based, rooted in pre-Christian tradition, but very modern, and like any other faith group, we are working to increase our intimate relationship with deity.
What's it like when the Christian Christmas is totally unavoidable? And what is the significance of this time of year for pagans?
Well, that's a funny question because I grew up Jewish. So I've always had that experience. The whole world is, you know, putting up trees and having Santa. And I always felt a little disconnected from that. And actually, upon becoming pagan, I learned of the pagan roots of many of the supposedly Christian traditions. Decorating trees, lighting lights, Santa Claus, exchanging gifts, all of these are pre-Christian. So to a certain extent, becoming pagan allowed me to enjoy the cultural trappings of Christmas in a way I hadn't as a Jewish kid. We're all celebrating the return of the light. And that's the truth. The truth is that at the winter solstice, it's the darkest time of the year, and almost every faith tradition does something to celebrate light and the fact that light will come. Whether it's the birth of the sun god, as we do in paganism, or the birth of the Son of God, as Christians do, or the miracle of light, as Jews celebrate, or Diwali, the festival of lights, in Hinduism.
What are the other markers of the calendar that are significant?
Well, I'm Wiccan, which is the largest religious group within paganism, and so I will talk about that because pagan faiths can be so diverse that I couldn't pinpoint all of them. But in Wicca, our regular worship services, what would be the equivalent of, you know, going to church on Sunday, would be our lunar celebrations, full moons, and sometimes both full and new moons. The holidays are 8 holidays, roughly evenly spaced around the year. We call that the wheel of the year. And they are the solstices, the equinoxes, and the days in between. What we call Samhain, Halloween, is probably the most important. And, of course, that's when I do the majority of my radio interviews because people are always curious about talking to Wiccans on Halloween. But after the winter solstice, the next one is called Imolc, which is February 1st. And that is, again, in the midst of darkness, looking towards the coming spring. And then there will be spring equinox, then there will be Beltane, which is May Day, summer solstice, Lammas, which is August Eve, fall equinox, Halloween, and then we're back around to winter solstice again.
Now, I understand there are many diverse pagan traditions, but what can pagan teachings, broadly speaking, offer to people of other faiths and of no faith?
You know, my late husband wrote an essay that is still widely distributed called What Do Neo-Pagans Believe? And it's really beautiful at expressing the things that we have in common. We are pluralistic. That is one of our key principles of just about every pagan, which is to say that we welcome other faiths. We are not singular in our point of view. We are polytheistic. Almost every pagan worships many gods. But it also means that we celebrate your choices to worship or not worship as you choose, and that is at the heart of modern pagan pluralism. We celebrate the powers and the authority of both and all gender. Women are very empowered within almost every pagan tradition. We are leaders and we are teachers, and we have every opportunity. Opportunity is not limited by gender. We tend to be body positive and to celebrate the physical and to celebrate the earthy side of human experience. So we tend to look upon things like pleasure, sex, eating, partying, celebration as more likely to be sacred than to be sinful. And we tend to emphasize the sacred over the sinful. Not to say there's nothing that is sinful, but our emphasis is on what is positive and joyful about being alive rather than what you should avoid.
It strikes me that we've noticed other faith groups recently picking up on some of these ancient ideas in recent years.
Yeah, I've actually seen other faith groups pick up things that I know started in modern pagan traditions, but I'm not grumbling about that. And honestly, maybe the people who talk about an age of Aquarius, a new age of being, are right, and these ideas are just going to go around. Paganism is self-consciously modern. There are reconstructionist traditions within the pagan movement, traditions that make an effort to use historical research to restore practice as it was in ancient times. For instance, there are reconstructionist Hellenists who are practicing Greek tradition as it was before the time of Homer. But for the most part, we are very aware that these are modern times and we are modern people. We embrace science as completely consistent and consonant with religion. They are not ever in conflict in our view. This kind of modernism, I think, is really important for people of all faiths if faith itself is to survive.
Deborah, if there's listeners that would like to find out more about the pagan traditions, would you talk about your books for a minute?
Well, I invite anybody to look at my website, deborahlipp.com. I've written a number of books. A very popular one called Elements of Ritual talks about how Wiccans perform ceremony. I have a memoir called Merry Meet Again that is coming out very soon in February. So if you want to read all about my life, that'll be available real soon. Or look at my website, and not only do I have my own books available, but I have recommended reading for people who are interested in learning more about paganism in general.
I've been speaking with Deborah Lipp, a Wiccan high priestess, author, and lecturer on pagan topics. Deborah, Happy New Year, and thank you so much for being with us today on State of Belief Radio.
Happy New Year to you, and thank you so much for having me.
Well, that's all the time we have for this week's show. Please visit us online at stateofbelief.com to find out more about the show, hear extended interviews, read transcripts, and sign up for our podcasts. You can learn about the new State of Belief app for iPhone and Android devices so you can listen to us anytime, anywhere. Share your thoughts on what you've heard on Facebook and Twitter. Contact information is available at stateofbelief.com, including the toll-free listener line, 800-856-0277. And as always, we encourage you to tell others about the show and encourage them to listen to join conversations about what we're talking about here. State of Belief Radio is a production of Interfaith Alliance. Please become a member today at interfaithalliance.org. We need you. And join us next week for more stories from the intersection of religion, government, and politics. Until then, you all take care of each other. I'm Welton Gaddy. That's State of Belief.
The only one who could ever reach me was the son of a preacher man. The only boy who could ever teach me was the son of a preacher man. You see, he was.